Bruce Edwards, and welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. In this program, IMF economist Patrick Imam on how citizenship laws can foster economic development.
So investors will not necessarily maximize their exposure to a country if they're not nationals. So you have communities without citizenship who feel that they are vulnerable and they have an incentive to store their money overseas.
The notion of citizenship is a relatively recent thing in that it only came about in the 19th century. But being a national or a foreigner influences one's financial decisions, which can have a significant impact on economies. Patrick Amir Imam is the representative of the IMF in Zimbabwe and co-author of Citizenship and Growth, published in the March 2019 edition of Finance and Development magazine. Imam says while some citizenship laws help boost growth, others can create conflict and instability.
So, Patrick, before we get too deep into this, how do countries determine whether a person has the right to become a citizen or a national? And what does it mean for these people to be in or out?
So to answer this question, one really needs to go back towards why citizenship laws were created in the first place. And I think the history here matters. So prior to the 19th century, in most countries, allegiance was to an ethnic group or to a feudal lord. It's really only with the emergence of a nation state in the 19th century that the primary allegiances were shifting from an ethnic group, a feudal lord, a religious group, towards the nation. And with the birth of the nation state came the need then to find a distinction between who belongs to the state and who does not. And therefore also to create a legal distinction between the ins and the outs, or if you like, between the nationals and the foreigners. And under the new rules, the nationals would benefit from rights such as voting, to work in the country, but also now in the 21st century, for example, to get social security benefits. And so the tool to determine whether a person is a citizen or not was really established in the 19th century or when countries became independent. And what countries used to do is they used to create a code of nationality, whose basic principles are mostly still intact in most countries. Very few countries have really changed their codes of nationalities since their inception.
And so how do these codes work?
I mean, there's basically two visions, if you like, and these visions are based on history. I wouldn't say that one is better or worse. They're really based on the historical circumstance of the country. So in one vision, which is really based on the Declaration of Human Rights, and which is quite inclusive, says that basically anyone can become a national or citizen of the country. And this inclusive version is really reflected in what we call the law of the soil or jus soli. And the principle here is that a child who is born in the country's territory acquires automatically the country's nationality, regardless of his parents, regardless of his racial, religious creeds, regardless of any other criteria. And in this view, the bond of citizenship extends beyond basic kinship, if you like, beyond blood ties. Mm-hmm. And it encompasses people from different ethnic, different religious, different genetic groups. Mm-hmm. And when there are many different ethnic groups and religious groups in the nation, citizenship is often the only thing that people have in common. And this is why this form of citizenship law, you find it very often in the New World, in the US being the most prominent example, and countries which historically have been populated by settlers. So this is one version. The other version of the citizenship laws is actually much more exclusive, and it defines the nation more as an ethnic group. And so this more exclusive version, we call it the law of the blood or jus sanguinis. And this promotes the principle that a child acquires the nationality from his parents with the place of birth not being a major factor. And this type of citizenship law, you tend to find it more in Europe, in Asia, and also parts of Africa. And by definition, this type of citizenship law is more exclusive in the sense that citizenship derives a meaning in part by excluding non-citizens from the same rights and privileges.
So can you give us some examples of countries that have adopted one approach or the other, and what has been the economic impact for these countries?
The two key examples that many people are aware of are obviously the U.S., and Germany, historically. So in the US, anyone who was born on the US soil automatically became a US citizen. The other one, but it has changed recently, was Germany. So in Germany, in the 1930s, adopted a relatively strict citizenship law, whereby citizenship was only extended to the children of German nationals. And the result was that you had, for example, large communities, notably of Turks, who had migrated to Germany in the 1950s, you know, after the end of the Second World War, to rebuild the country. And even though their grandchildren had only known Germany, they were not German citizens.
So what has been the economic impact for these countries having adopted one approach or the other?
So this is exactly what we try to answer in our question. You know, how do different citizenship laws impact economic development? And what we actually found is that, I mean, we used various econometric techniques and we subjected the data to a lot of tests. And what we found is that in advanced countries with strong institutions, the citizenship law didn't really matter that much. However, in developing countries with much weaker institutions, citizenship laws did have a large impact on income. So we found that countries which had the law of the blood or sanguinis, jus sanguinis, tended to have much lower income levels than countries which had the law of the soil.
And what do you attribute this this striking income gap? Because it is striking. In your research suggests that it's as high as 80% higher in the jus salis countries. What's behind this income gap?
So there are several channels that can explain the striking income gap. The first channel that we found was investment. So investors will not necessarily maximize their exposure to a country if they're not nationals. So you have communities without citizenship in countries with very weak institutions who feel that they are vulnerable and they have an incentive to store their money overseas. So they would not necessarily maximize their exposure to the country. And in particular around elections, you know, they will be very, very cautious. Okay. In addition, not only will they reduce their investment, the investment will also be distorted. Because if property rights are not well protected because of the lack of local citizenship, one goes for investment with a quick payback, like, for example, investing in the agricultural sector, or with very limited capital investment needs. So, for example, you will go into import, export, into trading. Mm. And no investment that require a lot of fixed capital that is not easily movable.
Right.
So this is one avenue that explains the difference in income gaps. The other one is really political instability and corruption. So in general, marginalized minorities without citizenship are oftentimes at polar extremes, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. You either they're excluded totally from economic life, or they play a disproportionately important role in the community. And so when a non-national group plays a disproportionate role in the economy, the lack of protection by the state is a source of concern for them, given that institutions are very weak. And because they are vulnerable, these influential minorities have an incentive to influence the political process through non-democratic means because they cannot vote. And one way of doing that is, of course, is to by paying bribes, by encouraging corruption, and therefore by weakening institutions. The third one is it tends to reduce public sector efficiency. So studies have documented over and over again that if you have divisions, whether it's ethnic, whether it's religious or linguistic, they often negatively impact public sector performance. They increase patronage, they lower the level of trust among the population, and ultimately they impact negatively on economic development. And the last aspect, I think, which really matters is the impact on the labor market. So under jus sanguinis law, local minorities without citizenship may be excluded from parts of the labor market. In many countries, you have entire professions that are not allowed to immigrants. So, for example, if you think about Thailand, foreigners cannot become hairdressers nor accountants. In Cambodia and Madagascar, foreigners are not allowed to purchase land. Even in a country like France, for example, non-EU foreigners are not allowed to become directors of funeral companies. So a lot of countries have imposed labor market restrictions on non-nationals. And so in these cases, a jus soli law expands the labor market in a way that a jus sanguinis law does not, and provides a potentially much larger pool of labor and creates a more efficient economy.
And have there been countries with one code that have moved to the other code? And what has been the impact of that?
There has. Citizenship laws are marked by history, and they change very, very slowly, but they're not static. And they involve, in some cases, often driven by economic or national consideration. Now, when you look at the legal traditions, I would probably differentiate between what's happened in developed countries and what's been happening in developing countries. So you have in developed countries, you have cases like Canada, which has not changed its law, because the laws that it had, the jus soli law, has actually been very effective for a country of immigrants. Therefore, it hasn't significantly changed its system. But in continental Europe, countries who have often been a source of immigration, and to keep the link with immigrants, the authorities have kept the jus sanguinis laws in place, like Germany, for example. However, Germany, because it became increasingly a country of immigrants, which was large Turkish and other communities, increasingly felt that to integrate these communities better, it had to change its law. And so what you see basically is that there remain big variations across countries and regions, but there's been a convergence between these two types of laws. But it's mainly done because these countries feel that they have large minorities and they need to integrate these minorities into the system. Now, in developing countries, the impetus to change citizenship laws came really with the decolonization period. So for example, in Latin America, countries switched to the jus soli law at independence, which was a departure from the civil laws that that they acquired from the European settlers, and where acquisition of citizenship law was by blood. And the move in Latin America was to break with the colonial political order and to prevent the former colonial power from making legitimate claims on citizens born in the newly independent countries. Yeah, yeah. So the idea there was really to break with the former colonial power. In many sub-Saharan African countries, which were created artificially by France, Portugal, Britain, and which lacked a sense of national cohesion, at independence, the citizenship laws were also revised, but in different ways, even though very often for similar reasons. So most former French colonies, they initially stuck to the principle of the jus soli law. Many former British and Portuguese colonies, however, at independence, they rejected the jus soli law, which was basically the law that they had acquired from the colonizers, in favor of a jus sanguinis law. And this was driven by ethnic considerations, because they thought it may create a national identity. And this was, I mean, I'll give you one example. For example, in the case of Sierra Leone, which at independence, or slightly after independence, created a constitution in 1961, which established that citizenship could only be transmitted by descent, and only to those whose father and grandfathers were Sierra Leoneans and of Black descent.
Yeah, but ultimately, that led to some conflict.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The problem with such law is that if you have a very heterogeneous ethnic environment, it will exclude various other ethnic and tribal groups. And this can create problems, especially when institutions are very weak. And you see this, for example, in the case of Congo, Zaire at the time. So the Congolese constitution of 1964, for example, in part to exclude Rwandan immigrants in the eastern part of Congo at the time, they recognized citizenship laws only for people whose parents were members of tribal groups that were established within the territory before 1908. And predictably, if certain marginalized groups are excluded, these marginal groups either become stateless, or in some circumstances, they will rebel as a consequence of these policies.
So your research also looks at the Lebanese diaspora, and you use examples in two different countries with two different citizenship laws. How do those two communities differ?
When we looked at the Lebanese, this was more a type of what we call a natural experiment. So what you had is that during the 19th century, current-day Lebanon and Syria were under the Ottoman Empire, and you had a large wave of Lebanese and Syrians who left the Ottoman Empire, and the aim was actually to go to Latin America. And on their way to Latin America, some people stayed in Africa and some literally got stranded in Western Africa, whereas the others went to Latin America. So you basically have people from the same group who went to two different regions and who turned out to be very, very successful, yet they behaved and responded to the local circumstances in a very different way. So one thing that they were encountering was different citizenship laws. So if you're in Latin America, you'll see the Lebanese community is actually very, very well integrated. In Brazil, the previous president, Temer, he was of Lebanese descent. Menem in Argentina was of Lebanese descent. My point being that in most of Latin America, the people of Lebanese descent are very, very well integrated in the political level, in the business community, and also culturally. And this is partly because they are subject to the jus soli law, and so they're citizens of the country and they're well integrated. And their long-term interest as a result in the rule of law, in good infrastructure, in good education, is basically aligned with those of the local community and of themselves. And so if there's a political instability, they're unlikely to be expropriated because of their ethnicity. Okay, this is, I think, one difference between Latin America on the one hand. And then in Western Africa, you have also the same Lebanese community who are experiencing very different circumstances. So if you look at Sierra Leone, for instance, there's a very small Lebanese community. And despite having been there for several generations, and despite doing very well, they're not citizens of the country because you have jus sanguinis law that applies in Sierra Leone. And this, it's a marginal community with not much visibility outside of business. And so their long-term interests may not necessarily be fully aligned with those of the citizens of the country, as they know they can be easily expropriated anytime. And the result is that the Lebanese in Western Africa may not benefit from a strong state as they would in Latin America, because the risk of expropriation means that they are myopic in their investment decisions, and they will try to keep as much money out of the country as possible rather than investing all their wealth domestically.
It's interesting. So if the benefits of this jus soli are so clear, do you believe that developing countries should be changing their citizenship laws?
I mean, citizenship is a very emotional subject, and it's very much based on a country's history. Think about the emotional debate that we're seeing in Europe, in America, and many other places around the world. So just because there are economic benefits to a citizenship law doesn't mean that a country would necessarily change its law. And what you're seeing around the world, as I mentioned earlier, is that this stark choice between a jus sanguini and jus soli law is starting to evaporate. Rather than having black and white, it's becoming gray, simply because most countries which have jus soli law, so the law of the soil, have over the last decades made it harder for people to get the citizenship. They've put conditions in. Think about France, think about the UK, two countries which historically had soli laws, they've imposed new restrictions. At the same time, you have countries which used to have sanguinis laws and which still have them, but which have loosened the criteria to become a national citizen. And I mentioned earlier Germany, for example, but you could imagine that more and more countries are moving in the same direction. So what you tend to see is, I would say, a blurring of these two models. The fundamentals are still there, and the principles of these two models are still different. But in practice, you tend to see these two models gradually converging, very, very slowly. And there's still clear differences between these two models, but you do tend to see that they're moving closer towards each other.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Patrick Amir Imam is currently the representative of the IMF in Zimbabwe and co-author of Citizenship and Growth, published in the March 2019 edition of Finance and Development magazine. Go to imf.org/FND to find the magazine online, or download the Finance and Development app to read it on your mobile device. And if you like this podcast, subscribe on your favorite podcast app. Just search for IMF Podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter @IMF_podcasts.